Understanding the enormous timescales in our planet's long history can be difficult, practically mind-boggling.
But Wisconsin writer Marcia Bjornrud hopes her new book makes that history accessible to more people, and at the same time helps us grasp the magnitude of our effects on the planet.
Bjornrud talked with Lake Effect Susan Bentz about the book, starting with the significance of its title, Timefulness.
So timefulness is a deliberate counterpoint to timelessness. We kind of have this idea that we like things to be unchanging forever and somehow hovering above us in a way that is eternal. But the fact is, everything is full of time, and the recognition of that can actually be something that helps us make peace with our own short time on the planet, but also understand our deep roots here as well. So geologists have this habit. We look out on the landscape and see the many different iterations that it records.
I'd love to start with that idea of looking out at the landscape, and one you share early in the book is a snow day in the 1970s.
Right. So I think anyone who's grown up in a snowy climate has had that wonderful experience of waking up to a bright white world and then learning that the normal mundane schedules have been suspended and all of a sudden, the day is yours. So I start with that. And a deep memory that I have of looking at our old world atlas, when people didn't use Google Maps all the time, and happening upon a page that showed all the time zones around the world, which generally run longitudinally. But there were a couple of places on this map that said no official time, so areas that were colored gray. And one of those was a remote archipelago in Arctic Norway called Svalbard. And I was just fascinated by this idea of this remote place that somehow had been exempt from time, measurements of time. As it happened, I actually ended up doing my PhD research in geology in Svalbard, and many years later found that it was not this romantic idea where time was running free, but in fact, a political disagreement between the Norwegians and the Russians, whether to use Moscow time or Oslo time there. But in a sense, the place was kind of exempted from time in being a bit of the ice age that was still with us, at least in the early 1980s and 90s when I was working there. More recently, when I've gone back, I've sadly found that time has come back with a vengeance to that place, and the ice age has lost its grip, and in fact, the place is changing faster than almost anywhere else in the world. So I use that old memory of a snowy day in Wisconsin as a starting point for my journey as a geologist and my relationship with time, both as a person and as a scientist.
Was it a certain something that motivated you to write this book?
Well, I think it's a growing sense of frustration with leadership and a growing sense of desperation as a scientist who sees how quickly human changes are affecting the Earth system, and trying to cast it in a new, fresh way, making a human argument for thinking scientifically about Earth processes. I think as geologists, ironically, we're partly to blame. For years and years, geology has been trying to inculcate people with the idea that the Earth is old and geologic processes are slow. And now we're trying to change the narrative to say, well, actually, the Earth can change really fast, and we're changing it. And I think part of the difficulty in getting people to take climate change seriously is that we've changed the narrative a little bit. Both of these things are actually true. The Earth is old, and in the main, geologic processes are slow. But on the other hand, sometimes things can change fast. And we are now, we as humans are now numerous enough that we are agents of the first order. So the book is an attempt to recast some things that maybe people have heard before in a more human framework, and argue that a scientific understanding of the Earth is imperative for us as a species, but it's also something that can be a source of some kind of existential solace as individuals.
So, Marcia, give an example of that recasting.
Well, a good part of the book is just kind of exposing the rates of different processes. So I talk about In Bob Dylan's song, Blowing in the Wind, Bob Dylan asks the question, how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Which is actually a rather profound geological question. And so in that chapter, I talk about rates of tectonic processes, of earthquakes, of erosion. And the point is that there are many overlapping rates. Again, some are underlying slow rates. The tectonic plates move at rates of inches per year, about as fast as our fingernails grow. So slowly, but not so slowly that it's beyond our perception. And then other times, of course, they lurch. They can move hundreds of feet in a fraction of a second in a large earthquake. So the Earth has many modes and tempos, some of which are so fast that we can't react. We think of the Earth as something that's kind of static, and we are the ones that are fast, but sometimes the roles are reversed, and we don't like it when the Earth does these sudden lurches. And the same goes for the climate. And sometimes climate change is really a slow process, but it can be accelerated at rates that become very uncomfortable for us.
So one of the elements, I mean, you pack a lot of information into really not very many pages. It's just exquisitely crafted, I think. One element is a simplified geologic timescale. It's amazing just to have these points of reference.
Yeah, and Wisconsin has a remarkable record of a big part of the geologic timescale. Of course, no one place, not even the Grand Canyon, has a record of all of geologic time. That the timescale has been put together over the last two centuries by thousands and thousands of geologists from all over the world, and little by little we've pieced together this global story of the whole planet. But I think often people don't realize that here in Wisconsin we have a remarkably long record of many parts of that long story, especially the old rocks in the northern third of Wisconsin record mountain belts that came and went, a great rifting event, sort of like what's going on in East Africa today, a hot spot interval where we would have been something like Yellowstone. So we have a remarkable record of a good chunk of Earth's long history in our backyards.
I am a person who appreciates landscapes and who places value on our resources. But you, as a scientist, a geologist, see landscapes differently than many of us.
I think that's true. And for me, it's something that it's like learning to read. Once you learn to read, you can't not read again. It's a habit of mind. It's a habit of seeing. An analogy that I sometimes use is that of palimpsest texts. This is a word that's used by medieval scholars, to describe ancient parchments that were inked, written on with ink, but then because parchment was expensive and difficult to make, they were reused, so the ink was scraped off, and then they were inked over again with new writings. But always there'd be some vestige of the earlier writing remaining beneath the more recent writing. And I think that's a great metaphor for the way geologists see landscapes. We can look out and see what it looks like today, but we can also see vestiges of these earlier versions of the landscape. And of course, may become faint at some point, but you have this sense that time is still with us, that the place has this long backstory. Another way I sometimes describe geologic thinking is to say it's the etymology of the world. It explains how things came to be. I've always loved word origins that give us this kind of insight into how the vocabulary that we use today actually has these deep roots in the past. And I think geology is that for every place on the Earth that we can look at.
There's the natural world and how we impact it, and then the regulations that our governments craft, presumably to safeguard those systems.
Right, to safeguard the systems, and I would argue ourselves. So the systems are robust. They've been around a long time. We can do damage to them. But in the end, nature will do what nature does. And especially with respect to the climate system, we think we're much more resilient than we really are. The Earth has seen hotter times and it's seen colder times, and ecosystems have come and gone with those climate changes of the past. But humans get really upset with the smallest little perturbations. A hurricane can come through, and we think it's the biggest catastrophe that we've ever seen. And we're not quite as robust as we would like to think we are. So I think, although I certainly believe nature should be protected in its own right, it may frankly be a more compelling argument, and it's also an accurate one, that we need to take care of nature so that nature will take care of us. Otherwise, we're going to see rapid changes that will cost us a lot economically, socially, cause political unrest, and that's part of the message of the book, that we're tinkering with nature in ways that are dangerous to ourselves.
Your own awakening began as a young person. You're a scientist. You're immersed in the deep history of our Earth. And now we have ever heightened concerns about, are we going to survive? Mm-hmm. Do you find that tempering your work with students?
I think it does. I think when I started teaching, especially as a woman in the sciences, I was always very careful to not show much of myself, maybe, in my teaching. And I've realized as a teacher and also as someone who speaks in public venues quite a bit, that that's probably wrong. As scientists, many of us feel very passionate relationships with the things that we study. As we get to know the natural world better, we develop something almost like love for the things that we study because we know them intimately. And I think it's okay to show that very human side of the sciences. Science is a very human endeavor. Understanding things in depth is, something that humans alone, we think, do in looking at the natural world. So I have slowly become more comfortable with talking about how science has informed my own personal worldview, both in my writing and in my teaching.
Could you talk a bit about what you see as the danger of time blindness?
Well, the fact is time passes. So we need to plan. We need to understand both human time scales and then the natural time scales that are commensurate with human activities. So my call for thinking like a geologist is really not that radical. I'm asking for us to learn to be able to think on decadal, maybe century kinds of timescales. That's the kind of timescale over which we can make government policy. We can have corporations acting on those timescales, and those are the ones that are going to be relevant for climate change that's looming over us.
As I see it, you're calling for a redemocratization, our view or our planning for the future.
That's right. Right now, the future is being left, no one is taking care of future generations. We don't really have that as a priority. And so the default is a future that we're leaving to our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, where they're going to be compounding problems in natural systems that will then aggravate underlying tensions in political and economic systems. And that's just irresponsible. Many people who are maybe would identify as political conservatives say we have an obligation not to leave debt to our those who follow us. So I would argue what we're doing to the climate system is leaving a very deep natural debt to coming generations. And that's something we should take seriously. We need to build into our political and economic systems mechanisms and incentives for longer-term thinking rather than short-term rewards, whether they're economic gains or political power. Most of the reward systems reward short-term thinkers.
So where do individual earthlings, how do we move on this?
Yeah, so I think we can take actions at different levels. As individuals, I maybe naively believe that a shift in our perception of who we are and learning more about the natural world, wherever you are, learning the names of plants and mushrooms and soil types, that's you as an individual, every day we can learn better about the natural environment in which we live. And it leads to a humility, I think, and an awareness that there are things that vastly predate us. We are not in charge of everything. So I think that's a starting point. Obviously, as an educator, I believe in the power of education. So we can fund better science in our schools. I would love to see earth science more represented in our public schools. And as voters and citizens, we can make sure that we're electing officials who have some understanding of natural systems and how human economies interact with those systems. So I think there are many levels at which we can act.
So think and act like a geologist?
I guess so. I'm not very objective, but that's a start anyway.
Marsha Bjornrud is professor of geology at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. Her new book is called Timefulness: How Thinking Like a Geologist Can Help Save the World. She talked about it with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz.